Everyone has a different hot button. It could be recognition, money, peer approval, acceptance, security, pride. You motivate people by tapping into their feelings and interests. And how do you do that? You know the answer by now. You listen and use questions to get information about what the other person wants. To move people, to motivate them to your point of view, you have to deliver a message that's personally satisfying to each and every one of them. However, don't fall into the trap of simply saying whatever you think they want to hear. There's nothing worse than insincerity. Once you're caught faking it, you'll never get your credibility back. But you can offer benefits that will appeal to them. You may be able to motivate your listeners to feel that they will be better people if they listen to your message. You may appeal to their sense of altruism or their desire to help others. They may be susceptible to their sense of pride and duty that others are counting on them. Discover their interests and appeal to them. Salespeople will often use leading questions to motivate potential buyers. Would you like to increase profits without spending another penny? Do you want to save money on the cost of heating or cooling your home?
Will you switch brands if I can prove to you you'll get more for your money?
Salespeople know that by offering an immediate benefit, they'll reach their first critical step in motivating or persuading their client to do something. Get them to pay attention. Then they use their questioning and conversation skills to continually involve the individual or group in their message. When you're trying to motivate or persuade someone, you must demonstrate that you care about them. And you can do that by remarking on things that they do well, wear well, or say well. You did such a great job on meeting the deadline.
I'm impressed with your grasp of the subject.
Boy, do you have a knack with children. Avoid criticism and focus on positives. Listen attentively and make eye contact. Pay attention to his or her body language to be sure that your message stays on target and that you hold the other person's interest. Don Sheehan, who was one of the greats on the sales motivation lecture circuit, talked about sincerity as one of the greatest gifts of persuasion. "Don't we all trust people who we know want to help us?" was his constant reminder about sales success. He could have been talking about motivating or persuading someone to buy a product, an idea, an opportunity, or a salary increase when he said, "True selling is not putting something over on someone. It's not stuffing something down his throat. No, I equate selling with friendship." You've reached that point in the course where you're ready to tackle the final challenge. With Tape 4, you'll develop a system for confidently handling difficult conversations. You'll become the master communicator you've always wanted to be. You know that questions can keep a conversation moving forward, as well as uncovering hard-to-get-at information, setting the stage for problem-solving and new directions. Good questioning techniques can put you in charge at meetings, social gatherings, one-on-one conversations, and presentations before large numbers of people. Peter Drucker, the well-known management consultant and author, says, "The right answers are the result of asking the right questions." That's more or less a modern-day version of a bit of ancient Greek wisdom. Socrates said about 2,000 years ago that a question well asked is half the answer. You've learned how to read body language and other nonverbal signals. You know that active listening skills will make you a better conversationalist, yes, even without saying a word. You've learned some secrets about motivation and persuasion, and how you can use all these skills to negotiate a better deal for everything from a car to a million-dollar business deal. And it only seems like a car costs $1 million today. And finally, you've had the opportunity to listen to some author-constructed quick starts. And more important, you've learned how to construct your own, having a never-ending arsenal of interesting thoughts and topics you can use at any gathering. There is one last skill you need to master. It's a six-step process that underlies all communication. It's the final step in connecting with other people. Think about this sentence.
When in the presence of another person, you cannot not communicate.
That's a little bit awkward, but the thought is accurate. When you're with another person, you're always saying something, even if you think you're not. How do you like this crazy weather?
Even the weather people don't know what's going on.
I guess we're kind of lucky today. A few degrees colder and this rain would have been about a foot of snow.
Yeah, that's all we need.
Wonder how bad the acid rain content is.
Who knows?
How do you feel about the problem?
Not much.
What is happening in this situation is that the woman is really disinterested in the turn of the conversation and felt she could cut off the communication by saying nothing. But the silence that followed her remarks is filled with all sorts of thinking time. What a diss. Once you get past the weather, she's got nothing to say.
Why does he always wait till I'm busy? Doesn't he have any work to do?
The point is that silence doesn't put a conversation on hold. In fact, the conversation continues internally, generating thoughts that may be quite negative. You may not have a clue as to what those thoughts are. No, the tape isn't defective. You just heard 5 seconds of silence. But I bet your mind didn't go blank with the tape. You were wondering if the tape was damaged or your player broken. You were wondering if you missed something. Perhaps you rewound the tape or fast-forwarded it. Whatever you did, you didn't stop thinking. And that's why it's important, even though you've mastered many conversational skills already, that you learn this final set of skills. You need to be able to understand what's really going on with your conversational partner. You need to be able to connect at a higher level to get everything you want from your conversational opportunities.
Jim, excuse me, but there's been a change in policy on when the employees can use the main parking lot. And I'd appreciate it if you'd distribute this memo.
Oh, hi, Ann. Glad you stopped by. Take a look at these pictures of my ski trip. Look at Bob in his ski suit, will you? Looks like the Pillsbury Doughboy. I'll tell you.
Well, that's nice, but if you'll put them aside, we have to move.
There's no silence here, but there's still a classic miscommunication. Ann needs to get out a corporate policy memo, and Jim's still on a high from his winter vacation. In a sense, they see each other, but they're really talking past each other. They're not connecting. All of us have been on either end of this sort of miscommunication. And the reason is that we weren't aware of or weren't paying attention to the six-step process that forms the basis for any meaningful conversation. The emphasis here is on the word meaningful. Relationships are made or broken through the things we say to each other. While we may be able to converse perfectly well at one level, we still run the risk of being misinterpreted or misunderstood. That's because many people will engage in a conversation without fully understanding their own position in relation to the person with whom they're speaking. The 6 steps that follow are your keys not just to becoming an outstanding conversationalist. They're your keys to improving communication and relationships at work, at play, and at home. Step 1 is identifying the subject of the conversation. What is the real issue, problem, or circumstance? In plain language, be sure you're both talking about the same thing. Step 2 is agreeing on the history behind the subject. What happened? Step 3 is agreeing on what the facts are, which often is not as simple as it sounds. One of the biggest mistakes people make in conversation is to confuse the facts of a situation with their own feelings and opinions. Step 4 is interpreting the history and facts. Why and how did it happen? Step 5 is identifying your emotional reaction. Here's where you can sort through your feelings and opinions based on the subject, the history, and the facts. And step 6 is determining a course of action. Once you and your partner have agreed on the subject, history, and facts, and you've both expressed your feelings and opinions, you then create an action plan. What do you need to do as a result of this conversation? What steps do you want to take? Some of us are very effective at parts of this six-step process. We may be good, for example, at identifying and verbalizing emotions, but not very good at all in deciding what to do about them. Some of us are very good at creating action plans, but we don't bother getting the facts first, creating all sorts of problems for ourselves and others. But by formally or informally using this proven system, you can develop a method for avoiding miscommunication and improving relationships. Follow along with this practice exercise that will help you put this process together. We're going to start developing this skill by listening to a manager describe a current concern of his. Listen for the facts.
I'm a manager in a large office supply company, and Barbara has worked for me for the last 2 years, and she's been with the company nearly 18 years. About a year ago, a totally new purchasing system was installed, and it was designed to be used on a personal computer. The problem is that Barbara can't quite seem to get the hang of it, even though she received extensive training on the system and the software, and she has a performance review due in about 2 weeks. Proper use of the system is a written job responsibility, specifically spelling this out as one of Barbara's performance objectives. She and I are the only two people who have anything to say about her performance. Also, her monthly summaries of purchases have been 1 to 2 weeks late for virtually every month that the system's been in place, and top management is very unhappy with the timing and the inaccuracies.
Let's review what we heard the manager say. He clearly identified four bits of information that are documented. There's no debate as to whether they happened or not. They are facts. The manager has stated that 1. Barbara has not produced accurate and timely reports that are, 2. A basic part of her written job responsibility. 3. She was trained to do the job. And 4. He has been warned by management that they will not accept any more inaccurate reports. So far, the manager has followed steps 1, 2, and 3. He has identified the issue that will have to be discussed. He has a grasp of the history behind the issue, and he's plotted or mapped the facts that you just heard. His next step is to interpret the history and facts. But before we go to that next step, let's take a step back ourselves and review why the manager is going through this process. Every day, our senses gather information about many situations. And just as our desks pile up with paper, our minds stack bits of information in our memories. In a week's time, you may have collected all sorts of data about 100 or more events. And then a month or so later, you want to have a serious conversation about some of that information you collected. Well, it's only fair to you and whoever might be involved in a conversation with you that you've accurately separated fact from fiction, opinions from beliefs, and attitudes from events. If you don't do that, your mind can get a little confused, and your story might just reflect an odd mixture of facts, emotions, and opinions. And you know the result, an argument or an unwillingness to communicate. Back to the manager, who's about to move to step 4, interpreting the facts he's mapped, to get as clear an idea as possible on where this issue is headed. What interpretations have you made based on his relationship with Barbara? Here are his interpretations of the facts.
I can't give Barbara a raise. If this continues, my job may be on the line. Barbara's lazy. I can't count on her performance anymore. She's not interested in her job.
Now, the manager hasn't arrived at any conclusions or solutions yet. He's still linking the various steps, which may be the most difficult part of this whole process, because we all have a natural tendency to jump from the facts to a solution, and that's dangerous. Listen to this conversation and think about what's wrong with it.
Did you hear about the robbery in accounting?
What?
Yep. It seems the cleaning crew broke into the petty cash box last night and cleaned that out along with the floors.
How do you know it was them?
I've been saying all along that security needed to keep a closer eye on them. Look, accounting's always gone by 5:30, and that's the first office the cleaning crew does. When Joan came in this morning, she found a rusty screwdriver on the floor and the petty cash drawer pried open. The box was smashed in. I figure one of the cleaning crew found that screwdriver while he was cleaning up and just couldn't resist the temptation.
Typical, huh? A quick jump from a few facts to an assumption or inference. That's exactly what you have to be able to analyze to become an effective communicator. Part of becoming a great communicator is definitely an art. That's the part where you choose the words, lower or raise your voice, smile, demonstrate body language, exhibit enthusiasm, and countless other touches you've learned as you went through this course. But the skill is the part where you analyze and structure, where you organize the parts into a system that helps you get the results you want. Before we move to step 5 and identifying emotional reactions, some background. Although things are starting to change somewhat, our culture has basically presented men as not having feelings, or of sublimating them consciously or unconsciously. Yet feelings are a major part of communicating. Not that they have to be expressed in every situation, but it's important that a good communicator be in touch with what they are.